it's really kind of beyond debate that wind is not a practical alternative energy for them because their community is so very small.
The village of Nikolsky has a wind turbine, but the state won't hook it up to the power grid. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 10th of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, farmers in the Mat-Su Valley try to hold on to as their land becomes more and more valuable.
I know farmers that get called every day. There's a phone call, and I buy your property.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
BP, proud to support public broadcasting in Alaska.
Senator Ted Stevens didn't appear in court today as the judge in the federal case against him ruled on most of the pretrial motions. So far, Judge Emmett Sullivan has mostly sided with government prosecutors' arguments. Alaska's Senator Stevens faces 7 counts of lying on his Senate financial disclosure forms to conceal gifts from oilfield services company Vico and its CEO. From Washington, APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Judge Emmett Sullivan denied 2 motions by Senator Stevens' defense team to dismiss the case. The defense had argued that the charges are unconstitutionally vague and that it should be up to the Senate, not the courts, to stand in judgment because the financial disclosure forms in question are a rule of the Senate. However, Judge Sullivan rejected both claims. The defense team also sought to have some charges dropped because of a statute of limitations, but the judge shot that down, agreeing with prosecutors that early allegations of lying back in 1999 and 2000 are part of an alleged pattern of behavior that stretched into recent years. In another blow to the defense team, the judge also denied their request to remove a paragraph in the indictment that claims Stevens did favors for Vico and its CEO, Bill Allen, at the same time he was accepting gifts. Instead, the judge said Stevens' lawyers could give the jury specific instructions about what charges he faces. Stevens is not accused of bribery, but prosecutors say they believe he hid the gifts in part because he was doing Vico favors. They say it's central to the theory of their case and speaks to motive. Judge Sullivan postponed ruling on a handful of other motions, including a defense team request to throw out the case because of the speech or debate clause. That says lawmakers can't be tried for what happens in the halls of Congress. The judge also has yet to rule on one of the prosecution's big motions. The government wants to support its case by introducing new allegations that Stevens received secret gifts, including favors for his family. Also yet to be dealt with, how much of the grand jury testimony must be handed over to the defense? And the judge must rule on the defense team's request for medical records of Vico's Bill Allen, who suffered a head injury in a motorcycle accident back in 2001. Allen is expected to be the government's star witness. The judge did help the two sides hammer out a plan to deal with information the defense wants about taped phone conversations and photographs. And when the defense team complained that the prosecution isn't handing over all of its evidence, Judge Sullivan reminded both sides of their obligation to turn over what they should and quickly. It looks like the case is keeping to its accelerated timeline, which Senator Stevens requested, saying he wants it wrapped up before he faces re-election November 4th. At one point during Wednesday's hearing, the prosecution grumbled that the defense has called this a simple case, but is at the same time filing substantive motions. Judge Sullivan asked the defense if they want to slow things down, but Stevens' lawyers said no and were adamant that the trial go full steam ahead. Jury selection begins September 22nd. Judge Sullivan will hold one more hearing next week to wrap up pretrial business. In Washington, D.C., I'm Libby Casey.
For nearly 1 year, the remote Aleutian Islands community of Nikolsky has been waiting to connect a wind turbine to their diesel power plant. Nikolsky was in the media spotlight last winter as they struggled to get fuel deliveries and were forced to ration what was left. Nikolsky leaders are hoping to help offset that fuel shortage concern this winter with wind power. Nikolsky Tribal Administrator Tanya Kyle says when the Alaska Energy Authority, or AEA, built their diesel plant nearly 3 years ago, the tribe requested a wind-ready system.
It was when the power plant was built. We had requested a control panel that would work with a wind turbine because that had been our plan all along, was to try to find the funding to put up a wind turbine here. And unfortunately, it just didn't work out.
Kyle says she doesn't know why they didn't get the system they requested, other than to speculate that perhaps AEA officials didn't think they'd get the funding for the wind turbine. But they did, through a federal grant. Some additional funds for shipping and fuel cost increases came from the Aleutian Pribilof Island Community Development Association, or APICTA. A $500,000 later, Nikolsky has an idle wind turbine that Kyle says could really help reduce their ever-increasing yearly fuel bill.
During peak usage, it probably would have saved our fuel consumption by a third, and during the lower times, at least a half, if not more.
But AEA Rural Power Systems Upgrade and Bulk Fuel Project Manager Chris Mello says it doesn't pencil out. Mello says the tribe got funding for a wind turbine against AEA's recommendations.
We analyzed the wind out there, and in our view, it's very plain, it's really kind of beyond debate, that wind is not a practical alternative energy for them because their community is so very small.
He says a representative from APICTA asked AEA for $180,000 to connect the wind turbine to the diesel plant.
And we said, look, we've been really clear about this before any money was spent on wind at all, that it was a bad idea and we would not be investing in it. Our position doesn't change just because someone did go out and invest in it. It doesn't make a lousy project a better project because they went out and they bought a wind turbine.
I think the information that Chris Mello has is old information, and I think the world has changed substantially.
Larry Cotter is the CEO of APICTA. He says TDX Corporation is handling the power plant maintenance on Nikolsky, and earlier this year, Cotter had TDX write up an analysis of fuel cost savings for the community if they were supplementing with wind.
And that number came in at $178,000 per year. Now, that figure was based on fuel prices at that time. And also did not take into account an additional significant power user that has since entered the community, that being some additional navigational equipment that uses significant power when it's turned on that the FAA installed.
But AEA's Chris Mello says wind turbines need regular maintenance, and because Nikolsky is so remote, that's an expensive prospect.
The cost of all of that, of bringing someone out to perform operation and maintenance services, is probably going to cost several thousand dollars. Now, there's about five or six homes out there. So who's going to go around and knock on the door and say, okay, your share for the repair on the wind turbine is $1,000. You got it?
APICTA's Cotter says those costs are inconsequential compared to the amount the community could save each year. He says it's ridiculous to fight over the cost of the hookup when Nikolsky would save that amount within 2 years. But Chris Mello says AEA won't change its position.
No, we're not going to invest in the wind project that we know is a dog.
In Nikolsky, as winter approaches, Tribal Administrator Tanya Kyle continues to hope the problem will be resolved. She says the tribe has subsidized fuel for community members, but they'll have to raise the rates again this year. And she says after last winter's fuel delivery problems, the wind turbine would help them feel more secure when winter storms make diesel deliveries impossible. Kyle says the community had also hoped to set up a waste heat system from wind power to heat their community center.
So at the very least, if we have to severely cut back on the fuel, we'll have one place where we'll be able to keep it warm enough that, you know, if people decide they want to, they'll have some place warm to stay.
The tribe also recently built a greenhouse so community members could grow their own produce throughout the year, but they can't afford to heat it until the wind turbine is operating. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, international recognition for a Native leader in Southeast.
I love anthropology and taking the knowledge of anthropology to looking at our culture.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
People are gathered in Fairbanks to welcome Governor and Vice Presidential candidate Sarah Palin back to Alaska. The Alaska Republican Party is sponsoring the fundraiser and rally at a hangar at Fairbanks International Airport, where Palin is expected to address the crowd at around 7 p.m. The event is open to the public, but Republican organizers have made it clear they only want Palin supporters to attend. They're not allowing signs into the event. A local peace and justice group has organized a roadside anti-Palin rally near the airport. Meanwhile, Governor Palin is being credited for a surge of support for the McCain campaign across the West. McCain Western Regional Communications Director Rick Gorka says that includes an increase in the campaign's volunteer base.
Throughout the West region, we've seen an incredible explosion of volunteers. In Washington State, we're up 750%, and in Oregon, it's up 111%. Just the sheer numbers of volunteers that are coming forward to help out Governor Palin become vice president.
Gorka says the volunteers are working phone banks and going door to door. McCain is also ramping up a presence in Alaska. Gorka says a state director has been hired and an Alaska campaign office is in the works. The Democratic opposition has been working the state hard for months already. Barack Obama has several offices in Alaska and a staff that's been working both urban and rural areas for support. The Matanuska Valley's growth spurt during the past decade has come at a cost. Some are worried that the valley's farmland and its agricultural heritage is disappearing much too quickly beneath development bulldozers. As APRN's Ellen Lockyer reports, a new move to protect the valley's open acreage is gaining ground.
Until March of this year, the Matanuska Sioux Sitna Borough did not require building permits for new residential construction. So there's no accurate count of how many houses have gone up in the past few years. Borough data indicates a slowdown in the borough's population growth of late, although a drive up the park's highway into Wasilla leads to a maze of shopping centers, car dealerships, and an urban sprawl that rivals anything on the East Coast. That's something that worries Palmer produce distributor Paul Hubert.
When you subdivide it and bury it under streets and concrete and that, you've destroyed the potential use for agriculture.
A right turn at the intersection of the parks and Glen Highways leads to Palmer. And at this very intersection stands a building that underscores the farmer's problem.
The Valley Regional Hospital going on Trunk Road certainly put a lot of pressure on farms adjacent to there.
Representative Bill Stoltz's District 16 is home to most of the small farmers in the valley, and Stoltz says he hears concerns about eroding farmland every day. The new Valley Hospital towers over surrounding hayfields and cow pastures. It was built on land once part of the University of Alaska Fairbanks's experimental farm on the Palmer side of the highway. Dr. Norm Harris is the administrator for the Palmer Research Center.
The experiment farm has been seen as the primary cash cow of the university system, prime land. And so this makes this land around here extremely valuable.
Development is chipping away at the experimental farm, too, which once covered 1,000 acres. Harris says the experimental farm will lose an additional 25 acres to road realignment next year. And he says part of his job is to preserve the farm's acreage from developers' inroads. As it is, old barns close to the hospital are being remodeled into coffee shops and gift stores. And last year, one abandoned barn down the road was actually trucked away to a museum in Wasilla. As if Matanuska farming belongs to a dead age. Valley farmland, once given to potato fields and cow pastures, has become so valuable to housing developers that many farmers are worried about being able to pay property taxes. Paul Hubert says farms deserve tax breaks because farm families use fewer services than do subdivision dwellers.
As you take, for example, a man and woman with two children that's in the school system, that's on a lot in a subdivision, demands much more service than a man and woman with two children that's on a small 40-acre farm.
The Matanuska Sioux Sitna Borough gives a property tax break to farms with a percentage of the land in production, but older farmers faced with retirement are tempted to sell.
I know farmers that get called every day. Some farmers are close to or adjacent to gravel pits. Name your price. We'll pay it. We don't care because we just want the gravel underneath. You know, it's such a tempting thing when they're struggling as they do.
Steve Gallagher manages the nonprofit Alaska Farmland Trust, which aims to offset development inroads by paying farmers to put restrictions on privately owned agricultural land. The concept employed outside since the 2002 Farm Bill is a new one to Alaska. It uses federal programs and donated cash to keep the land in agricultural production. Gallagher says it's a win-win because farmers receive money up front now, which compensates for selling only to agricultural interests in the future.
You know, they don't have 401ks, they don't have retirement plans. Their retirement essentially is in the land. And so that's why this we're trying to do this program to help them be able to retire and then restrict the property so that way an actual beginning farmer could afford to purchase the property and farm.
Borough Assemblyman Rob Wells, who served as director of the State Division of Agriculture for 5 years, says the state could be doing a lot more to help preserve farmland.
The borough assembly has stepped up over the last two budget cycles to invest some public funds. I would suggest that we ought to look at it on a statewide basis to get the matching funds that are necessary for the Farm and Ranch Land Protection Program.
Dr. Norm Harris says it's a fallacy that Alaska will always be able to import enough food rather than produce its own. And the experimental farm? Carol Lewis, who is UAF's dean of the School of Natural Resources and Agricultural Sciences, says the Palmer land is safe for now.
It's a jewel in the crown of UA lands, and we see in its future more recreation research, more interactive work with the community through a learning center.
But she says 250 acres of the farm adjoining university-owned land is under consideration for sale for the development of a gated residential community. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The Cold Bay airstrip, often used as a backup when airports in Anchorage or Fairbanks are shut down, finally has a place where passengers can stay warm. The new Cold Bay Airport Terminal is open. Tony Gorman of member station KSDP in Sandpoint reports.
The $5.1 million facility has waiting rooms on the first floor that will hold a capacity of 120 people. There's also space for freight storage and handling. The Aleutians Eastborough will lease office space on the newly renovated second floor. The National Weather Service was the first to secure a spot by signing its lease last month. They began moving into their new home this week. Jim Smith is in charge of the National Weather Service office in Cold Bay. He says he hopes to have everything up and running by the end of this week.
We're looking forward to, again, providing our support for Cold Bay and vicinity, and I think we'll just be able to do a real good job out of that new building. It's going to be real nice to be warm and dry and have reliable stuff around you.
The agency's old facilities were damaged by a storm last December. Since then, the National Weather Service and the Federal Aviation Administration have been splitting time between their old FAA building and an office in one of the airport's old hangars. Negotiations on a lease are in the works to bring the FAA to the 11,400-square-foot facility. Penn Air is the only service offered in Cold Bay. Borough Administrator Robert Jutner says he hopes the new building will attract larger carriers like Alaska Airlines. He says the borough has been trying to lure the Seattle-based carrier to the region's largest airport for the past 3 years.
There isn't any public facility there. There's the old Reeve Terminal and the small Penn Air Terminal. And basically we were told, if you don't build something, we'll never come. That's not a promise that they're going to come, even though we built something, but that, you know, if we don't build it, we won't come.
Construction was completed last month. A new apron is the final piece of the puzzle. Jutner says the FAA's runway visibility zone restrictions prevented the borough from building the facility on its existing aprons.
We're waiting for the state to catch up and build us an apron and to incorporate our terminal building right into the airport.
The building will also serve as a terminal for those using the hovercraft service to and from King Cove. It will definitely help in emergency situations. There is space available to open a potential gift shop, restaurant, or snack bar just in case passengers have an extended stay in Cold Bay. I'm Tony Gorman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Public Radio Network. Promotes Alaska's cultures, regions, and ethnic diversity, including a commitment to informing and empowering Alaska's Native peoples.
A Southeast Alaska Native leader is being recognized internationally for her work in anthropology. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports on an award won by Rosita Worrell, a Juneau-based cultural and corporate leader.
Rosita Worrell believes anthropology should be more than academic research. She says the study of human society and culture needs to have a practical application.
In this modern day period, you have to be analytical about your culture. At one time, you know, we were able to just live our culture. But when we came in contact with other societies, of course, we had these cultural encounters. And so now to be able to integrate our culture into modern institutions, you have to be able to understand and say, these are our cultural values, and then be able to understand impacts on these cultural values.
Worrell's work as a teacher, advocate, and organizational leader led her to win the Solon T. Kimball Award for Public and Applied Anthropology. The award recognizes contributions to the development of the field as an applied science with public policy impacts. Worrell, who is Tlingit, has a long history in Southeast Native Affairs. She's best known as president of the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, a Juneau-based cultural and educational organization. She also is vice chair of the board of directors of the Sea Alaska Regional Native Corporation. Worrell also teaches at the University of Alaska Southeast. Dan Monteith is an anthropology professor there and helped prepare the nominating petition.
She's one of our kind of special treasures in terms of a professor and teacher. And not only is she great because many of our Alaska Native students can identify with her, but just her breadth and depth of knowledge about anthropology, but also her experience as an anthropologist, a practicing anthropologist in the state, lends to her classroom abilities and being able to teach students.
Worrell is the 13th person to receive the biennial award given by the American Anthropological Association. Monteith says it's in recognition of public service.
Rosita and her work with repatriation, her work on committees with other international kind of indigenous organizations in particular, I think, is noteworthy and brings her quite a bit of recognition, both nationally and internationally.
Worrell helped the administration of former Governor Steve Cooper develop a policy establishing the state's relationship with tribes. She's also been a leader of the Alaska Federation of Natives and has been involved in the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of the American Indian. Worrell says she knows many Native Americans are suspicious of anthropologists who sometimes clash with traditional knowledge or practices, but she says Alaska Natives need to be involved in the field.
I love anthropology, and I think I conveyed that to a number of my students, because if you walked outside there, you'll see a number of my former students. You know, first they were working here as interns, and now they're here working in the field of anthropology and taking the knowledge of anthropology to looking at our culture.
Worrell has doctorate and master's degrees from Harvard University and a bachelor's degree from Alaska Methodist University. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Earlier this week, the Anchorage School Board dealt with a situation it hadn't encountered in several years, more students enrolling than predicted. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
In its 2008-2009 budget, the school district projected a September enrollment of just under 48,000 students. On September 3rd, enrollment passed 48,100. By Monday, that number had jumped another 100 students. The unexpected numbers produced an administration request for more teachers and tutorial aides. School Superintendent Carol Como told the board that the need for a September staff increase fit a once familiar pattern.
I realize it's been 4 years since we've been in this situation, but this used to be routine every single fall.
While this fall's enrollment exceeds the 2008 projection, it does not reverse the continuing falling student numbers of recent years. Last year, Anchorage's September enrollment was approximately 48,500, about 300 more students than this year's latest tally. Still, the unexpected students have produced that staffing shortfall. The administration requested hiring the equivalent of 18 full-time teacher positions, 15 for elementary schools and 3 for the high schools. The district also asked for 15 and a half aid positions, namely English language learner tutors and special education teacher assistants. Total cost of the staffing boost? A little over $1,700,000.
At this time, we're not asking for increasing of the upper limit. We'll watch it carefully because when we submit our paperwork on the 20-day count period in October and reconciliation of the OASIS report, we'll have a better idea if, in fact, we need to go back to the, well, to you first, to increase the upper limit overall and then go back to the Assembly. But at this time, we're not asking for that.
OASIS stands for Online Alaska School Information System. The OASIS reconciliation report Como referred to resolves disputes where two or more districts might claim the same student for revenue purposes. The 20-day October count period is when the State Department of Education determines the exact number of students enrolled in a school district. That figure is the basis for the state's per-student funding support. School board member John Steiner said one aspect of the staffing request troubled him.
Yeah, I certainly have no objection to having enough teachers so that we're not having way oversized classes, but could I please get a little more explanation on the finances? If we're not changing the upper limit, then this money is coming out of some currently budgeted category.
Administration staff said several remaining unknowns made it difficult this early in the school year to determine exactly how close the district was to its budgetary upper limit as authorized by the Anchorage Assembly. But it looked like sufficient wiggle room might arise for the needed funding. Como assured Steiner the administration would not overextend the budget. Other areas would be cut if necessary to assure sufficient classroom staffing. Member Tim Steele had another worry.
My concern is that we're going to have a tough time trying to hire people because school's already started most places. We certainly need to get out there as soon as we can and start trying to hire those folks.
Como said the principals were already contacting possible teachers. She didn't say how the tutor and aide search was progressing. The board unanimously approved the hiring request. Como told the board the late student registrations may continue.
I actually met with Gloria O'Neill from Cook Inland Tribal Council, and I've talked to Margie Brown in the past from Siri. Their information is that a number of families are truly waiting to get the rebate checks and the PFDs, so they have enough money to kind of close up their living quarters and then pay for the transportation to come in.
Como says that rural influx is likely to impact primarily the Fairbanks, Mat-Su, and Anchorage school districts, and could extend through September into October. This is Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tony Gorman in Sandpoint, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Ellen Lockyer from the Mat-Su Valley. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.